This would have left survivors in the situation of recovering. My math may be out of date because we have updated statistics, but I remember from a year ago the number was about $8,000 per person, which obviously would not come close to compensating anyone for serious injuries or loss of family members. So the fund was created in the legislature, the last legislative session, to try to provide compensation to the survivors and the family members of those who did not survive the collapse. And we are here today to hear from the special master panel, which was charged with distributing the funds, as well as representatives from the of the victims and some of the survivors themselves. So to start, I think we'll hear from the special master panel that was charged with distributing the funds. And if you could please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. My name is Susan Holden. I'm an attorney at practicing law at Tudor Wilson von Holtom in Minneapolis, and I was appointed chair of the special master panel, and I'm here with my two colleagues today, Steve Kirsch from the Murnan Law Firm in St. Paul, and Mike Tewksbury from Tewksbury and Kerfeld in Minneapolis.
Please proceed.
Thank you. We were appointed May 29th, 2008, by Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice Russell Anderson to serve as special masters in this special compensation process designed for the survivors of the 35W bridge collapse. The role of the special masters was to consider claims, make settlement offers, and enter settlement agreements with the survivors, and to set up the claims process that would allow us to perform those duties in accordance with the law that was passed. The special compensation process was restricted for the benefit of survivors. And that term, survivor, was carefully defined in the statute as a natural person who was present on the bridge at the time that it collapsed, and also included family members who survived someone who died in the collapse, or a legally recognized representative of a survivor who was on the bridge at the time that it collapsed. When we mentioned survivor today in our comments, it is that statutory definition that we are referring to. The panel established a fairly comprehensive claims process in order to administer the funds that were appropriated. Immediately after we were appointed, we met to outline the process that we anticipated and started considering categories of information that we would need to accurately, thoroughly evaluate the claims that would be presented to us and to meet the deadlines and other requirements of the law. We designed a group of forms for the survivors to use in submitting their claims to us, and we also developed the settlement agreement and release form that was approved by the Attorney General's office and that would be signed by each survivor who decided to accept a settlement offer made by the panel. People did not have to waive any rights in order to participate in our process. In other words, they didn't have to opt in. All they had to do was submit their claims and meet the deadline of October 15th that was set out in the statute. And they could decide after they learned what their settlement offer was whether or not they would accept the settlement. To better define and refine our process, the panel convened some joint meetings in June and July, meetings with representatives from the Attorney General's office as well as some of the lawyers who represented groups of the survivors who we anticipated would be submitting claims. We wanted their input. We wanted to design a process that not just met the requirements of the laws but would serve some of the concerns and meet the needs of the survivors that we were going to meet throughout this process and gain some consensus and hopefully establish some credibility for our process. Those meetings were very helpful for us in that regard. We got great participation from the lawyers involved that helped us define this process. Another important element of the process that we designed was to make sure that survivors had access to the information that they needed, accurate information available to them 24/7. And the only way for us to accomplish that was to develop a website that we had hoped to show you today. Having some technical difficulties establishing an internet connection in this room, so we won't be able yet, anyway, to display that website. It is called bridgecollapseclaims.com or bridgecollapseclaims.org or bridgecollapseclaims.net. No matter what dot you use, you will get to the website, and it will it has all the information that folks needed to file their claims. It has the claim forms. It has some frequently asked questions. It has an overview of the process, instructions, deadlines. We thought it contained the information that people would need in order to meet the deadlines and requirements of the law. The claim submission deadline in this statute is October 15, 2008. That is not a deadline that the panel could extend. It was written in law, and everyone met that deadline. We received 179 claims by the end of that deadline. No one tried to submit a claim after that deadline. So the people were apparently well informed of what the deadlines were, and everyone met them. The applications themselves consisted of several documents. We devised claim forms that included a general information form that was the contact information for the survivor and the lawyers that represented them. It included an opportunity for them to elect the type of meeting that they would have with the special master panel. You may be aware that this law setting up the special compensation process required that at least one member of the special master panel meet with each survivor. We learned through some of those joint meetings that there may be people that did not want to actually meet with us in person. And we also knew that there were certain types of claims that we wanted to meet as a panel. And so we gave people the option of selecting either a full panel meeting, a single member of a panel meeting, or they could submit written-only submissions. And we had 9 of those that were submitted as written-only. A few of those we had to contact anyway to get some questions answered or to obtain some additional documentation, but there were 9 of those that waived their meeting with the panel. 70 of those we met with as a full panel, and 100 cases we met with individually. And the 3 of us divided up those single panel member meetings and scheduled them throughout the course of the weeks that we were completing the hearings. But even if a case was a single member of the panel meeting, we all read their materials and deliberated every case together. We met weekly in order to do that. A day or two each week would be set aside for the panel to complete the full panel meetings with survivors, and then also use those days and additional time if needed to deliberate the cases that we had individually done the week before. In those meetings with the survivors, we tried to make it as comfortable a process for them as we could. A very important part of this process was to give the survivors an opportunity to tell us their story, to help us understand what had happened to them and how it had affected them. The meetings were non-adversarial in that there were no cross-examinations. It wasn't sworn testimony. The survivors and their lawyers presented to us the comments that they wanted to tell us, and then we, of course, had questions for them related to their presentation or related to the written materials that were provided to us. And it gave us an opportunity to ask questions about types of damages that were raised in the claim forms and that type of thing. The other claim forms that were submitted were damages claims forms, and there were 3 types of damages claims forms. There was a personal injury claim form that included information about how the person had been injured and what their medical treatment had been and what their medical bills were and their loss of income and all types of elements related to their personal injury claim. The wrongful death claim form, of course, was for family members of those who died. There were 13 death claims submitted to the panel. In addition to that, one submitting either a personal injury claim form or a wrongful death claim form could also submit a property damage claim form if they had some vehicle damage or other types of property loss as a result of the bridge collapse. all of the claim forms, and they are displayed on the website. If you have curiosity and would like to look back at the detailed information that we requested, each claim form had a list of the types of documentation that we would need. For example, if someone was asserting a claim for future medical expenses, we requested they provide us a medical doctor's or some medical professional's written opinion about the need for future medical care, what it would consist of, and some information about the cost of that type of care in today's dollars. That's an example of the type of documentation we'd request along with the information provided in the actual form itself. There's also a damages adjustment form that was a part of the claims packet. You may be aware from the statute that this compensation plan did not anticipate repaying what we call subrogation interest or reimbursing health plans and other insurance companies for the benefits that they've paid on behalf of survivors. So we needed to know what had been paid and what was still outstanding. And so the damages adjustment form was designed to provide us the information that we would need to complete the offer of settlement calculation anticipated by the statute. During our weekly meetings in which we deliberated cases, we would review all of the materials, talk about what we learned in the presentations provided to us by the survivors, and reach some consensus about the various values for the injuries and the types of damages, loss of income, past and future, medical expenses, past and future, and make preliminary damages determinations in each case that we would refer back to later on. We were not sure when we started this process whether there would be enough money to fully compensate the survivors for the offers of settlement that we calculated. So we proceeded to hear all of the cases and make our preliminary calculations, and then when we reached the end of the process, to go back and review that and see how those numbers compared with the appropriations. There were two appropriations for this compensation process. The total funds were $36.64 million. The first $24 million of that fund is what we called the General Compensation Fund. That was intended to compensate any type of damage that was appropriate to claim under Minnesota's damages laws. But that fund was capped at $400,000, so no individual could recover more than $400,000 from that fund. The remaining $12.64 million was called the Supplemental Payments Fund, and that was there to pay uncompensated medical expenses and lost earnings or financial support. This fund could not be used to pay for things like emotional distress, pain and suffering, disability, or the more intangible elements of loss that people sustain in a personal injury or wrongful death claim. The panel had a deadline under the law in which to complete our settlement offers. That deadline was February 28th. Of this year, and we met that deadline. Each survivor who presented a claim received a settlement offer from the panel that was based on the amount of their damages and the total funds available to compensate all of the damages submitted, and in light of the damages caps and the restrictions on the supplemental payments funds. So how did we go about that process? The statute did a very good job of outlining what it was that we were to consider and how that we were to reach the offer of settlement calculation. And first, we started by determining a total damages figure for all the elements of damages, and from that then deducted those benefits that a survivor had already received from other sources. One of my colleagues will be commenting in more detail today about what types of things we considered in determining damages, but I can tell you that the total damages calculated for all 179 claims totaled over $99 million. and the author of settlement calculations based on our calculation of total damages minus those benefits that we were to offset exceeded the available appropriation by $9.7 million. That was $4.4 million for the capped general compensation fund and $5.3 million for the supplemental payments fund. And so we had to go back and evaluate each case and do some reductions in a fair manner to arrive at ultimately what were the final offers that went out to each of the survivors. The survivors had 45 days in which to accept a settlement offer. That was a timeline that was required by the statute. That deadline passed last week on Thursday, April 16th. And by that deadline, all 179 survivors had notified us and provided us with all the documentation needed to confirm their acceptance of our settlement offers. That deadline of April 16th was critical because had they missed the deadline, the statute would operate to rescind the offer made by the panel. And we had developed a process in case we needed to employ it that if an offer was rejected or rescinded by operation of the statute, that the panel would redistribute those funds to survivors who had accepted settlement offers but who still had uncompensated losses. So although we were prepared and had a redistribution process in place, we were glad that we didn't have to use it. Everyone accepted their settlement offers within the deadline. Court approvals were required for many of these settlements before survivors could confirm their settlement. Injuries to minors and claims for wrongful death must be court approved in accordance with the general rules of practice for district courts. It's Rule 144 for wrongful death claims and Rule 145 for settlements on behalf of minors. And a minor is a person under the age of 18. The court approval of most of these claims, in particular for the minor settlements, had to happen within the 45-day time period prescribed for acceptance of claims. And we required that when survivors accepted by providing assigned settlement agreements that they also provided us with a copy of the court order that authorized their acceptance of the settlement and the distribution on behalf of the minor. There were 68 cases subject to court approval. That included 13 wrongful death claims and 55 minor settlement claims. In order to speed the administration of those cases that required court approval during the limited 45-day acceptance period, the panel worked with Hennepin and Ramsey County District Courts and State Court Administration to ensure that we would have a process in place that would accomplish court approvals in the quick, tight time frame that was necessary. And we received great cooperation from the courts. There was no filing fee that had to be paid for minor settlement approvals that were filed in Ramsey or Hennepin counties. In addition, all of the settlement matters that the panel knew needed court approval were pre-assigned to either of those counties so that they could contact judges ahead of time to get on the schedule and reserve a judge's calendar time in order to hold a hearing during that 45-day acceptance period. Both Hennepin and Ramsey counties really rose to that occasion and set aside judicial resources so that we could be sure to get these court approvals done. Most of the survivors in this process were represented by lawyers, and the lawyers provided a great service. We encouraged survivors to consult with an attorney to represent them throughout this process. Although having a lawyer was not a requirement, we encouraged them to do that. They were very skilled attorneys, and I understand that you will hear from some of them today, who are experienced in advising clients about personal injury claims and wrongful death claims and the nature of the damages that they can claim in each of those types of cases, and to help people gather the necessary documentation and expert opinions that the panel needed to fairly evaluate their claims. And the lawyers served on a pro bono basis. That means no fees were charged to the survivors for that legal representation. And I'd like to recognize the work of those lawyers who did that and thank them for their service. Chris Messerly and Phil Seif of the Robbins firm put together a group of the pro bono consortium, as we called them, a number of skilled personal injury attorneys from all over Minnesota that donated their time on behalf of these survivors and made the panel's job much easier in this process. Most of the settlements have already been paid. We have had a standing meeting each week at the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget, and our state's CFO, Dennis Munkowitz, who is seated here in this room today, is the one who has met with a member of the panel or one of our assistants and signed every piece of paperwork that the state must have a signing representative on to accomplish these settlements. That includes all the settlement agreements and releases. In the case of a structured settlement, and there were 68 of those, there is a qualified assignment document and some additional paperwork that needs to be processed, and Mr. Markowitz met every week and signed those papers, and a group of dedicated, hardworking staff in his office made sure that we had all the checks to go with each settlement agreement that he signed each week, so that on the same day that Mr. Munkowitz and the panel, we would be able to take that check with us and disperse it to the survivor or their lawyers and get the process concluded as promptly as possible. As of Friday of last week, we had dispersed payment on 147 of the claims, of the 179 claims submitted. The bulk of the remaining settlements will be paid this week. There are only two settlements that will not be paid by the end of this week. We're awaiting some final documentation related to those two cases, but otherwise all claims will have been paid. My colleague Steve Kirsch will talk a little bit about what documentation the panel used to evaluate these claims, and that will be followed then by my colleague Mike Tewksbury talking about some of the reductions and challenges that we face in that process.
Thank you. That's good, Christine. First, identifying yourself for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Steve Kirsch. I'm the Token St. Paul Special Master. I'm going to go through a little bit on how we came up with these numbers, because a lot of people have questions about that. Between the three of us, we had over 75 years of experience in handling cases. We've all arbitrated cases before. We've all mediated cases before. Obviously, this was a unique situation because, in a way, we serve as a three-person jury, and we also served as a three-person judicial panel of judges. We had to determine the facts of the case, and we had to determine the law. And we followed the Minnesota jury instructions, which is exactly what a Minnesota jury would be asked to do. And we were limited and bound by Minnesota law. And you may be surprised that some of the jury instructions that we use in this state are, we tell the jury that they can't speculate, and we tell the jury that they can't let sympathy interfere with their decision. Obviously, when you hear 100 cases and you have to decide 179 cases and 13 of them involve families who lost a loved one, and dozens of cases were catastrophic injuries, sympathy is a human reaction, and we all had to work through that to honor our commitment to the law and the ethics. I've been practicing law for over 33 years, and I have never experienced the 3 or 4 months that we went through and listening to these survivors testify. I think the hearings were crucial. We had to evaluate these people. We read their records. The claim forms were created to give us as much information as we needed. We looked at the 9/11 claim forms and decided to do our own, to make them user-friendly for the people who wouldn't have lawyers. We didn't want to pry too much because the way the law was written, it was not adversarial. But at the same time, if somebody had a prior injury or a prior workers' compensation case or made certain claims in the past through prior medical claims, we needed to find that information out, so we asked it as gently as we could. And it may have applied to maybe a dozen cases, but by and large it didn't. We went through expert reports. People who had injuries had their treating doctors write us a letter telling us what the permanency would be. People that had surgeries and are going to have surgeries in the future, we had to have reports to determine that, because that is an area that the law requires some expert assistance. We have the discretion not to follow all of the reports. For instance, if you had a 30-year-old person and a doctor said that that person would need 45 years of chiropractic treatment in the future, and here's how much that would cost, we have, as a jury and a judge, the discretion to say, I don't think that that's reasonable, and we could make our own decisions. And we had to do that in every case we looked at. We had to scrutinize the information. We learned a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder. The lawyers for the consortium were kind enough to arrange an interview with one of the leading experts in the country from Harvard, and we spent 2 hours asking questions of this very, very eminently qualified person who had written so much on this subject. And it was very important for us to understand this, because many victims, many of the survivors, had what we felt were legitimate post-traumatic stress disorder claims, or certainly issues, if not that diagnostic evaluation, they went through stress and an unbelievable situation. That was an important part for us. We learned a lot about compression fractures. We learned a lot about surgeries and knee injuries and head injuries, and we had to evaluate all of those claims. What is that worth? And do you do it per surgery? Do you do it per the permanency rating? And does the age of the person enter into it? All of these are relevant considerations that a Minnesota jury would consider, and we considered it many times. We all went through each case many times. The death cases, doesn't get any worse than that, and we had 13 of them, and they were obviously the most difficult. How do you put a value on a human life? I mean, how do you do that? There's no perfect way to do it, but the law in Minnesota gives us guidance through our jury instructions, which are very, very helpful to us. Everybody that passes away, there's a value to that life, and there's an effect of the family that is so profound. And no amount of money can bring those people back, but the law provides monetary compensation. And if people look at the amount of the death cases, I think they'll find that there are different amounts, because every family situation is different. But some of it is a sort of an economic or mathematical computation. There's the loss of aid, comfort, and society that the decedent had to the survivors in the family, and that's all case by case with dozens of factors to consider. And then there's also the economic situation. The law says that if a person has a $50,000 job and another person has a $100,000 job and they're the same age and they have the same life expectancy, the person with the $100,000 job is going to have a higher calculation in the pecuniary loss. That's what the jury instructions tell us. The death case hearings, unfortunately, in our scheduling, we had 5 in one day. And that was just the unluck of the draw to get all of these cases evaluated. We did not have a matrix, or we did not have a grid. Nobody fit into any slot. We evaluated 179 cases separately. We gave preliminary numbers after we heard cases, but certainly we had to go back, because maybe the first couple weeks would be different from the last couple weeks. We were learning, and we were learning a lot. We were learning a lot about the kids on the bus. We had to calculate the special damages. What were the medical bills in the past? What would be the medical bills in the future that passed our scrutiny? What would be the past wages? What would be the future economic losses? All of these factors we had to consider, just like a jury would. So in the end, fortunately, we all knew each other before we were put together on this task, and I think the collegiality and the trust that we had in each other helped us set some guidelines on how we were going to evaluate it. I learned after 33 years of practicing law that evidently I was evaluating scars too lightly over the years, because my colleagues convinced me on several occasions that when we went around and put down numbers for scars, that I may have been a little bit low. And it was that give and take on every single case many, many times over that we eventually arrived at the numbers that we did. So I hope that that gives you a little background on how we arrived at the numbers. Thank you. And Mike Tewksbury is going to talk about something now.
Please identify yourself, Mr. Tewksbury, and proceed.
My name is Mike Tewksbury. I'm practice law in Minneapolis with the firm of Tewksbury and Kerfeld. We do personal injury work. We got what I would want to address, because we've had some questions since we completed our work, is how we got to the final numbers after we had come up with the preliminary numbers. As Ms. Holden indicated to you, when we wrote on a blank slate, we ended up with slightly over $99 million as the total value of the loss. From that, we then deducted the subrogated amounts, those amounts that were paid by no-fault carriers, workers' compensation carriers, and health insurers, because the statute indicated those parties could not be paid back out of the settlement. And if they would not waive their claim, the claimant would not receive the money. We were able to accomplish that and obtain waivers from all of those companies that held the right, whether they believed the law to be valid or not. From that, then, we had a number of claims, and particularly the death claims, where there were elements of damages, aid, comfort, guidance, and assistance that loved ones lost by reason of a death in the family, that were compensated within the first $400,000 but would not be available from the second fund, because that was not an identifiable damage that the second fund could compensate. That fund was limited to wage loss, earning capacity, medical expenses, and the fund also made clear that it had to be uncompensated medical bills, which would be compensated first. So that eliminated some additional money that we thought the value of the case had and brought it down further. Under Minnesota law, if a health insurer makes payment of a medical bill at a reduced rate, so the bill is $100 and the company pays $70, but it discharges the bill, an injured claimant still has a right to make the claim for the full amount of the $100. In that circumstance, we determined that the claimant wasn't really out any money because the medical bill had been discharged. So we went through, and even though you would be entitled to that in a tort action in a district court, we reduced those damages because we felt the claimant wasn't out in. Having gone through that process, we still ended up, as Ms. Holden indicated, approximately $9.7 million above the amount that we had been allocated to spend on this. It was approximately $5 million in one fund and $4 million over in the second fund. So the task then fell to us about how to reduce them. The statute provided us with a little bit of guidance, but a little bit of leeway as well, in that it said we could do that on a proportionate basis or in some other manner that appeared to be just. It also indicated that claimants who could make a claim into the second fund had to have a claim in excess of $400,000. The statute did not indicate, however, that they had to receive $400,000 from the first fund. So we interpreted that to mean that while we found their claim to be in excess, we didn't have to give everybody in that fund $400,000. And so we made a reduction of the death cases got the $400,000, and we made a reduction of 10% of everybody else who went into the supplemental fund, which then generated another $1 million for us to use in that first capped $400,000 fund. We went through the analysis, well, what if we take the $9.7 million that we're short and divide it by the 179 claimants and just reduce it that way? That's a nice mathematical way to do it. The problem is that results in a reduction of a little over $50,000 per claimant. If you look at the final payout, there are approximately 75 claimants who received less than $50,000. So that would have eliminated 40-45% of all of the claimants. The same debates that all of you participate in when we deal with taxation on whether it should be a graduated or it should be a flat percentage across and who does that impact, we had those discussions and we ended up with a hybrid system in which we did some percentage discounting and then we also made various categories depending on if your claim that we thought was in the 10 to 20 range, you got reduced a certain percent, 20 to 30, 30 to 50, 50 to 75, and they all got reduced down so that we ultimately fit within the cap that had been allocated to us. What we found by doing that, with tinkering with the numbers a little bit at the end, we were able to maintain the order from the 1 to 179 in how we had evaluated the cases from the most damaged to the least damaged. So while in any particular case you can engage in a discussion of should they have gotten $5,000 or $10,000 more or $30,000 more, we were confident that we had them ranked in the order from most serious to least serious, and we were able to maintain that ranking with the final awards.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Concluding comments or?
I know we're prepared to take questions if there are any.
First of all, I want to thank the three of you for the work that you did. As you've alluded to a little bit, we gave you a very, very difficult task, a task that I don't think the legislature was very well suited for taking up, which was trying to figure out how to evaluate, set principles in place, and do the kind of tough, difficult work of considering individual cases before trying to make up a decision about compensation. The dollar amounts that we appropriated, we knew or we suspected, but we didn't know, would not fully compensate everyone. So we anticipated that you would have to make difficult decisions. And I guess I want to thank you first for being willing to do it. And I want to should recognize that former Chief Justice Russell Anderson did a tremendous job in picking the three of you, which I knew he would because he's a good Bemidji boy just like me. So he did an excellent job in picking you, and you have done tremendous work. And I think wading through a very, very difficult assignment and doing it, I think, in the best traditions of the Minnesota legal system, the best traditions of Minnesota, and I personally had confidence from the beginning that we had lawyers and people in the state who would be able to do this job well and far better than we, the legislature, could ever do. So I want to say thank you for that. I have some questions, but I know committee members do too. We'll go first, but I guess maybe we'll start with Representative Kahn.
I'm interested in how you thought the idea of the two separate funds was and how you thought that worked. Was that helpful, or would you have rather had you just give us a... have us just give you a lump sum?
I thought that it was helpful to have that second allocation of funds to really get at the serious financial loss that many of these folks experienced, but that you had to recognize in the first fund they were going to be capped, and there'd be no way to compensate some of that really burdensome financial loss that some of the survivors experienced. That second fund allowed us to soften that blow and to focus a priority on those particular damages. So I thought that was visionary and very helpful to the panel.
Thank you. Representative Kleiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of thank yous to the panel here has already been thanked, and I've been very impressed, too, just as an outsider looking in, and particularly today at your work. You must have been painstaking and taking a lot of time, but you obviously did excellent work. I also want to thank you, Mr. Chair, you know, you've gotten credit, but probably not nearly enough for what you've done. And for those who are new to the legislature or new to this committee, you may not know the countless hours that Representative Winkler put in last year, along with others, to make this happen and to really create from scratch something that we had really never done in Minnesota before, that was innovative, that was flexible, and that ultimately, as we're hearing today, was just. So I think we all, not in this, only in this committee room, but the victims and their families and everyone owe Representative Winkler a tremendous amount of thanks. This was his baby from the beginning, and I think he, with the help of many others, of course, executed it flawlessly. So thank you, Representative Winkler. I have some questions, though, about just some sort of general questions. You mentioned that the tension, obviously, between giving you leeway and giving you, you know, specific authority. And I'm wondering, as you look back on your experience, were there any places where you thought there was too little guidance or too much guidance? Was it just right? It couldn't have been right each and every time. So could you tell us, if you had to do it over again, and if we were to do it over again, and you know, God forbid we have to do it over again, is there any, which way would you sort of move the needle along that continuum?
You know, it really was a process that worked well. There were some challenges in it. I'm not sure that it means that you should change the way that the law was constructed. We thought the whole construct gave us a very clear idea of what your intentions were here at the legislature when those funds were appropriated. There were challenges like we didn't have enough money and there was a great need, but the balance was struck fairly, I think, in the amount of the appropriation. Certainly better than a single per occurrence limit of $1 million, as Representative Winkler referred to in his opening comments. But it made for some hard decisions for the panel by having a fixed pool of funds rather than an unlimited pool, for example, in the 9/11 commission process, that once they made a decision about the value of a claim, they could simply pay it. I wouldn't advocate that there not be a fixed pool. I'm just saying that created challenges for us. There was a correction in the statute to clarify the intent in this legislative session related to waivers of subrogation interest. It may have been helpful to have that information earlier, but frankly, it took implementing the process before we could see that. So I really don't have any significant changes that I would make to the law as it was set up in order to accomplish the purpose intended.
The other thing that the statute required was that the claimants sign a release. And the way the statute is set up, it was designed to eliminate any responsibility, legal responsibility, or percentage of fault for the happening of the accident that the state might have by settling out what ultimately is determined to that percentage. It went further, however, in indicating that should any of the claimants proceed and obtain funds in excess of what we set as their total value loss, the state has an opportunity to be paid back. They have the claimant has an obligation to pay the state back. That was a new legal concept. In terms of, we have releases in place that have been recognized by the Supreme Court for years to settle out the percentage of fault and allow people to go forward, but it also eliminated the opportunity to get money back. So the legislation required a release that we had to invent. Time will tell whether in the court system they deem that to be appropriate and whether it will accomplish the goal of the legislation. But that was a new document and may very well be one that now emerges in tort law throughout the state as well.
Representative Simon.
Just a follow-up or two. I'll try to be quick. I'm hearing from all three of you that you generally like the way this was structured. Again, I hope we never have to invoke any such model again, but if we were to, I guess the first part of the question is, do you think this would be a good model or template for other disasters of this kind? And then secondly and relatedly is there any circumstance that you can think of where this might not be the right way to go? I'm asking you to speculate, obviously, and maybe you just can't or won't, but
Minnesota law won't let us speculate. To answer your question, I think it was, time will tell, but it turned out to be very, very well drafted and helpful because it gave us, it was the law we had to follow, and there was no gray area in a lot of these situations. I think one of the clever parts of the law was it made our decision final, and that gave the finality and the speed upon which these checks were sent out. I mean, that was part of the legislative intent, is to be fair, but get these people money. And when you think about an August 1st incident, and people are paid, less than a year and a half, or about a year and a half later, that's faster than one case in the court system. And you had 179 cases that start and end, and I think part of the value of that was, good, bad, or indifferent, they had no appeal process. If they took our settlement offer, they were stuck with our decision. And 179 out of 179 accepted it. Now, maybe they didn't have a better alternative because of the caps and immunities and things like that, but the point is they all knew it would be final. And so I think that was very helpful to have that. I wouldn't think for future catastrophes, in hindsight, the one thing all three of us have talked about is that maybe we would work on the waiver language a little earlier or some of these other legal technicalities, but until we got into it, we didn't see all of that. So I'm not sure in hindsight there would be very many significant changes at all.
Representative Fine.
Just one more quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hate to drag you into an ongoing policy debate here at the legislature, but I will. And ask you whether this persuades you one way or another about whether Minnesota ought to consider lifting the per occurrence cap, or do you think that's sound policy?
Mr. Kirsch.
I'm a defense lawyer, and my two colleagues are plaintiff lawyers.
Can I amend my question? I mean in circumstances such as this.
Oh, okay.
Circumstances such as this. If something, God forbid, like this were to occur again, in a circumstance like this, is that a possible solution that might augment what we've done here?
Steve Kirsch. I think the victims of the First World Trade Center didn't get any payment. The victims of Oklahoma City didn't get any payment. And I think we could go on and on, Columbine and all of that. It's a public decision. As an attorney, I think there's value to having the cap and everything the way it is. There's public policy for that. But in this particular case, when the state might be involved, I think there's public policy reasons to do such a special fund like you did. And I know it's a controversial issue, but I mean, if I had to vote on it, I would have voted to do exactly what the legislature did. I'd come out on that side.
Ms. Holden or Mr. Tewksbury, want to weigh in on the other side?
Well, no, not necessarily. I will weigh in, but I'm not sure that I'm going to be on the other side of that. I think it was an important policy decision that the legislature made to create this fund. I think you should do that on a case-by-case basis, rather than having there be an expectation that there's going to be a special fund every time there's a bad occurrence in our state, but reserve it for those cases like this bridge collapse that cried out for a remedy. And I think it was the right remedy at the right time. And it could be a template in the future.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo Representative Simon's praise and thanks to you for the very fine blueprint that I know you worked hundreds of hours on we have in our hands. And having spoken with you a couple of times through that process, I know that the subrogation issue was one issue you struggled with that I think we heard a little bit about, but I know the payments from other sources was also of concern, and I think it was Ms. Holden who said that all third-party payers did come to the table whether or not they thought the law was valid. I don't know if it was you, Mr. Kirsch, or Ms. Holder, and I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on some of the lessons we might learn from the arguments that these other sources brought to the table in any way that we could clarify it. I think it's a big concern for future issues, and I just hope you could shine some more light on it.
Ms. Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was an important policy decision that was incorporated into this statute that ensured that taxpayer dollars were not going to repay insurance companies, that the goal of this compensation fund was to get at the human suffering and the financial impact to individuals, and try to remedy that as best you could, and not permit all kinds of claims for reimbursement or subrogation by all the various insurers and health plans and other constructs that were out there paying benefits, whether they were employer-provided plans or insured plans. We did get very good cooperation from every plan that was involved on behalf of a survivor. There is one waiver that we are waiting for in all of those claims. That is one piece of paperwork that's holding up payment on one of the claims. There's a 40-day time period that is ticking, but we expect that when the right piece of paper lands on the desk of the right person, that too will be a claim that was waived rather than had to be challenged in a court of law over this no payment of subrogation interest out of these special compensation funds. I thought it was a good result. If you did this again in the future, I think a good use of taxpayer dollars is to get at the human suffering and the financial loss and not to be repaying other entities.
If I may add one thing, not in to contradict my colleague at all, but to add an issue that from a scholarly academic standpoint, one could argue that the workers' compensation folks have a statute that says that if they pay workers' compensation benefits, they have a statutory right to sue the alleged tortfeasors. And one could argue that there's a conflict between the legislation that we're dealing with and law that's been on the books for decades. Having said that, and insurance companies don't get a lot of good press these days, but I think the workers' comp carriers and the auto people and the health people, whether they initially liked it or not, they did play ball and they did go along with it. We had some feedback from some minor players, and we decided early on that, well, we'll have the Attorney General's office call them. And it was amazing, all except in one case, how many times the Attorney General's office would call these people. The next day we would be faxed the waiver. But my only comment from the legal standpoint on subrogation is that the workers' comp situation may be a little different than some of the other issues.
Representative Kahn.
One of the differences between this fund and the federal 9/11 fund was that I think in order to apply for that one, people had to waive their right to sue before they saw the result. I thought it was better, the way we did it was better. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, it works. So
we've discussed that. We concur with that. It is. It gave people the opportunity to see what the panel was going to give them, make a determination of whether that was fair or not, and then they could make a decision whether they wanted to take their chance in litigation against the state. In the 9/11 fund, I read Mr. Feinberg's book before we actually started with this to find out what he had done and the observations he made, and it appeared from his material that a lot of his time was spent trying to talk claimants into waiving their rights and joining into the fund. So it seemed to me that this was a much better way to do it. It left everybody with their opportunity to choose, and we're thankful everybody accepted the offer.
Anything further from the committee? Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, panel, I'm just curious about the nine that didn't want to meet with you. Were there any special circumstances for that?
No. A couple of the people lived out of state, and it wasn't convenient for them to come back in and meet with me personally. And instead of having them feel like they were ignored completely and only read on the record, we contacted them and talked to them personally. And a couple of them were relatively minor injury claims with a large property damage component and not a lot to discuss. And so if we needed additional documentation, we'd contact them. But there were no real significant injury claims where there were a lot of issues for us to evaluate that we didn't actually meet face to face with the person.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to, I think, ask Mr. Messerly to come up next. I do want to just say that Mr. Feinberg of the 9/11 Fund did come to testify with the Joint House Senate Claims Committee, and he gave two pieces of advice. One was don't set up a special compensation fund, and however, if you do, make sure you give people a chance to be heard. And it sounds like he was 50% right based on your testimony today. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chris, come on up, but I don't know if there are any other attorneys that represented any of the claimants here. Oh, okay. Mr. Messerly, please state your name for the tape, and then I guess we'd be interested in your perspective on the process and the fund from the advocate's point of view.
Well, my name is Chris Messerly. I've been with Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Streese for more than 25 years. We, within days of this tragedy, created what we've casually called the Pro Bono Consortium. We've provided free legal services to the majority of the people on the bridge, over 115. And we recruited as part of this 19 other law firms, from solo practitioners up all the way from the Iron Range down to southern Minnesota, who all share in representing clients while our firm takes the lead on experts and other things. And as most of you may know, I was very actively involved from early on with the legislative process, and I was grateful that I was given an opportunity to be heard and be a voice for these innocent people who have lost so much. And it goes back to a young man I had never met before, and I'd never heard of him before, so maybe he's your campaign manager, but Mr. Ryan Winkler came to me early on knowing that we represented these people and said, how can I help? And, you know, I'm very grateful for Representative Winkler. I'm very, very grateful for those in the Senate who have helped, and not just me, but believe me, everyone, very grateful for the House, for the Senate, and for the governor. For doing something, quite frankly, didn't have to be done. But I think everyone realized the enormity of this tragedy, and the state has done a good thing, a very good thing, and should be very proud. And it's brought out a lot of other things, this whole process that you've created here. It's brought out a bunch of lawyers who may not have the best name in the world because they're lawyers who do this totally for free because they just want to help and think it's the right thing to do. It involves doctors we'd call to get reports for this process who would volunteer to do it free, which is not a common thing. It involves all sorts of people who pitched in only to help those who were on the bridge that day and those who lost loved ones. So I think it's brought up a lot of great things. The special master panel, I don't think will ever receive enough credit. While they're very humble about this, they did an absolutely outstanding job. And the legislation that was created here, that created this three-person panel, allowed the former Chief Justice to pick three people who were exceptionally bright, were exceptionally experienced, exceptionally experienced in the law, have level heads and level judgment. And a very important part that has been overlooked by many is that they all have a heart. And by that I don't mean they're sympathetic to the award people money because of that, but they have a lot of compassion. And when I asked Ken Feinberg to come out here and paid his way to speak with this group, he said one of the most important things of that whole process was people would have an opportunity to be heard. And while we spent a great deal of time preparing this, there was a lot of apprehension on behalf of, I think, of all the folks who came and testified. And it was not an easy thing for them. But I think for many, there was something good about being able to talk. And the special masters listened. They not only listened, but they heard. And And I know, well, I haven't talked to them about this, and they'll probably never talk about it. I know of the pain that they, endured in hearing these stories, because not any of us who represent these people and get to know them and respect them and treat them as friends and our clients can sleep well at night, can do anything but feel a depth of sorrow beyond anything. And these special masters heard these stories, and we sat in there with our clients who told these stories, and they listened, and I think people felt better because of that. And while we all knew from day one there wasn't enough money there, and all of the people on the bridge knew that, despite that, everyone was grateful for what was done. Everyone was pleased with the process, how the special masters listened and were so considerate and careful, and pleased with what came out of it. For some people, nothing good had happened since August 1. And when I talked to some of our clients and told them what the special master panel had awarded, there was a pause and just tears on the other side. And first I thought, oh my heavens, I hope you're not that upset with what they've done. Well, I have nothing to do with that. They were just pleased that something finally good has happened. And it gave them some flexibility in life to, whether it's work part-time to care for their kids because they're a single mother, or deal with their injuries, pay for some therapy that they couldn't get paid for otherwise. Those are all wonderful things. And I just think the speed has been a good thing, and I'm just very proud and honored to be part of this, and most importantly, proud and honored to be able to do whatever I can do to help these people who are on the bridge that day.
Questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Chris, and thank you for all the work that you have done from the very beginning of this tragedy as well.
Thank you.
And I know that we had discussed having Jennifer or Betsy, Mercedes, or Linda potentially come up and testify, and anybody who, any of the survivors who wishes, certainly please come forward. And all together or individually, you don't all have to talk, whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Thank you.
Whoever wants to go first, please say your name and proceed.
Sure. I'm Jennifer Holmes, and I lost my husband, Patrick Holmes. And I just want to say that I felt the process went very, very well and very, very smooth. We were all represented by very, very good, wonderful lawyers that really cared about us and wanted to help us, and they made the process pretty easy for us. They tried to do whatever they could to help us. And then in meeting with the panel, you know, none of it's easy, I wouldn't say, even, you know, over a year and a half later. It's not easy to meet and talk about it or say how we're feeling, but they gave us the chance to come talk to them, and they were very kind, and I think they did an awesome job of doing what they could to help us.
I'm Mercedes, and I agree with everything Jennifer just said. I think the process was made to be as smooth as possible. We are so beyond grateful for Representative Winkler authoring this bill. It's unprecedented, I think, and all of the legislature for supporting the bill. Really, I think, changed a lot of our lives for the better. I just had my 10th surgery and don't know what the future holds, so I'm really pleased with the outcome, and it's all part of the healing process, and just really pleased with the outcome. So.
I have a question for Mercedes.
Yeah.
Did you get to dance on your wedding day?
I got to dance on my wedding day, so not very well, but...
Something many of us can sympathize with. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Jennifer and Mercedes. I want to thank you for being willing participants and engaging very openly when I'm sure was a very difficult choice and difficult process. You know, Minnesota has been there with you, and And I want to thank you for being open and sharing your stories, which I know can't have been very busy along the way. And it's been an important healing part for the state, I think, for you to be willing to share your experiences, not only publicly, but also to be willing to engage in the process. And Representative Winkler deserves more credit than we can ever give him for being our conduit at the legislature from the House. But I think you should also be extremely proud of dealing with what was a private tragedy in a very public way. And I know South High Tiger grads have the grit and courage, being one myself.
Oh, right.
In fact, I think we might have been a year apart. Thank you very much from the bottom of my heart, but I think on behalf of a really grateful state for being so open and brave to let us share in your stories.
We're happy to do so.
Other questions or comments from the committee members? Okay. Well, I want to, again, thank you for being here. Some of you were here, I guess, no, but I think one of the, either Mercedes or Jennifer or Betsy or Linda, were one of the four of you, I think, was at every single legislative hearing that we had on this topic, and there were many, many legislative hearings on this topic. So it's good to see you back here again today. And I hope, I guess all of our hope, is that even though we can't undo what was done, we can't change mistakes that were made, we can at least try to recognize that and try to in some way honor and do what we can to lessen some of the financial burden that it was imposed on both of you and all the survivors. So thank you for coming and helping us through that process.
Thank you.
No, anything further from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I think I just want to make mention. I just want to make mention of the letter that we had from the cult of family that again also just said what, how much faith and how much they appreciated the whole process. So I think what was done was incredible, but the way it was handled, I think most people are very well satisfied with.
Representative Kahn.
Actually, the special master did such a super job. Maybe we could try and engage him for the state government finance conference.
There you go.
No, thank you. That would be too much to ask. That was a return.